From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Friday, May the 22nd in 2020, and we have a good show lined up for you today. I do think later on in the second hour of the program, we're going to be talking to Commissioner James Baker and Facilities Chief Al Cormier of the Vermont Department of Corrections about that department's response to the coronavirus crisis. And they've been, of course, much in the news lately on that front. And going to be checking in with the commissioner and with Mr. Cormier right around 10:15 or so. In the second half hour of this first hour on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV, we're going to be talking with Meg Hansen. She's a Republican candidate for lieutenant governor, and checking in with Meg about what she has on her agenda as a budding Vermont politician. And in the first half hour, I was going to go to just open phone lines and invite listeners to call in with whatever thoughts they've accumulated over the course of the week, might want to share with us. But I want to actually focus this a little bit, at least for the first few minutes, on a discussion that's been going back and forth, started with a phone call to the show a few weeks ago from one of our regular callers, Rama of Williamstown, who made a reference to, I believe it was to President Trump's rallies being like Nazi rallies. And at the time, I thought that was a little bit over the top, but I didn't say much because, frankly, a lot of times practical considerations intervene. I think I was about to go to a break and a change in subject here on the Dave Graham Show. And so I just kind of let it slide. Thanks for the call, and let's move on. And I got a couple of emails in the subsequent days on that comment by Rama. And it was interesting, the sort of range of thinking. One person was basically defending President Trump and taking offense at anyone referring to him as a being sympathetic to Nazis or whatever. And the other one came from a gentleman who was offended that anyone would compare really anything else to the horrors of the Nazi Holocaust and the what happened in Europe just before mid-century, in the 20th century. Obviously, a really horrible piece of history then, and I must say I took that to heart to some extent. And then I had some subsequent follow-up emails with Rama, in which I was basically arguing that I think to use the Nazi label is a powerful thing, and that if there's ever a resurgence of Nazism really getting a toehold in American politics, then you want to be able to call it out, and you want to be able to say the Nazism is here, and you don't want to be taken as someone who's been saying that for a long time and might be regarded as sort of as a boy who cried wolf, or you got to have some credibility left at that point. And so I was sort of saying, keep your powder dry, save this charge for when you really need it kind of thing. And Rama actually wrote back to me and accused me of, quote unquote, walking with Nazis. I then essentially was pretty insulted by that and asked Rama to find himself a new radio show to call. So, fast forward to yesterday and today. Yesterday, President Trump was out in Michigan at the Ford plant there that he was touring it. They've been involved in manufacturing masks in the coronavirus crisis, and he was there to celebrate that and made a couple of remarks about Henry Ford, the company's founder, talking about how Henry Ford had good bloodlines. He repeated that, good bloodlines, good bloodlines. Henry Ford, for those who don't know, was a pretty virulent anti-Semite and actually owned a newspaper, the Dearborn Independent, as well as his car company. The Dearborn Independent published a whole lot of anti-Semitic tracts back in the teens and 20s. Really, terrible stuff, talking about the international Jew, the being the world's problem, et cetera. And how Jews were undermining America and blah, 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 all that stuff. And Henry Ford was actually singled out, according to The Intercept. I read this morning in The Intercept. Was singled out. The only American singled out for praise in Hitler's Mein Kampf was Henry Ford. And at the same time, he was sued in 1927, recanted some of his statements, but I don't know how sincerely, because then in 1938 he accepted a medal awarded to him by the Nazi regime. And so there's a really ugly history there, frankly, folks. So now comes President Trump talking about how Henry Ford had good bloodlines. I must say the word bloodlines caught my attention because I've read up a little bit on the history of Nazism. And in fact, I was looking today at a glossary of Nazi terminology, and there were no fewer than five different terms referring to blood. The Nazis had a real concern with blood and blood purity and all this sort of thing. One of their famous slogans was Blut und Boden, which means blood and soil. There was another term in the glossary called blood consciousness, basically being aware of your and proud of your, in this case, all German blood. And so to hear this term used by the president while praising Henry Ford was pretty jarring to a lot of people. In fact, didn't get a whole lot of attention from the New York Times or the Washington Post, but some other U.S. media have done stories on it, and it's been quite a bit of news in the Israeli press overnight. Haaretz had one of the important stories about it. If you go to Haaretz.com, I guess the bottom line here is that we have a president who, at the very least, has a penchant for a very poor choice of words on this topic. Now, let me try to put the best possible spin on this thing for President Trump. First off, Henry Ford is not of German descent. He's of Irish descent. His family came from a little town near Cork on the southern Irish coast. And Hitler obviously was very concerned about the Germanness of people's blood lines and so on. So Henry Ford, I mean, maybe this is just, as I say, it could have just been a bad choice of words. But actually, we have Rama on the phone right now checking in with us. I sort of suspected he might call. Good morning, Rama. Rama, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Am I here?
Good morning.
Now?
Yep.
First off, let me start with that initial email I sent you did not accuse you of walking with the Nazis. It said if you're not fighting against them, you're walking with them. That's what it said. So how you interpreted that probably was some interpretation as to how you felt that you were acting. So I didn't then. The second email where I did say, I hope, are you enjoying your walk or some snide comment like that? Okay, that made a different statement. Let's remember now, you're once again, and Dave, you try to really milquetoast every issue. This is my opinion, okay, what I'm stating here. This is how I hear you. And you just did it again a little bit ago here where you said, well, maybe it was a poor choice of words on Trump's part. Let's flash back to Charleston, right?
Charlottesville?
Pardon?
Flash back to Charlottesville?
Charlottesville, right. I'm sorry. Yeah, Charlottesville.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, and where we had a tiki torch parade of a bunch of white people going down, and it was a long parade, too, chanting, Jews, J-E-W-S, will not replace us. And I got to tell you, I had such a hard time believing that that's what they were actually chanting. I had to listen to multiple videos before I was convinced that they weren't saying Y-O-U, will not replace us. They were, in fact, saying Jews, J-E-W-S, will not replace us. Those were some of the fine people that Trump was referring to that were on both sides of the issue there in Charlottesville. So these comments about Ford, well-known Nazi sympathizer, these comments about Ford were not accidental. They were very deliberate. He knew exactly what he was referring to. And there is no accident. I mean, when the white wing of the Republican Party has come out in full force, plain as day, right in your face, and says the things that they're saying, you got to believe them. When they talk like Nazis, they're Nazis. I don't care how you want to. You can say, oh, you just can't paint the people with a broad brush like that. Well, fine. Stop associating yourselves with the Trump, and I'm not saying you specifically, in a more general sense. People should stop associating themselves with the Trump, McConnell, GOP, VTGOP, Nazi, white wing, however you want to put it. These people are racist to the core. Not everybody that associates them with them is racist to the core, but they are associating themselves with people who are racist to the core. That's what I'm saying. This is my argument with the Catholic Church. You can't sit there and say you love the Catholic Church and then ignore the fact that at an institutional level, they actually aided and abetted people who were committing child rape, child molestation, and probably worse. You know, so we go through this issue of you cannot associate. In Germany, you could not associate in the 1920s and 30s. If you were associating with the Nazi Party, you were part of the problem. The same is true today. And if we don't wake up and realize it in another year, we could very well end up with that future in hand. That's my argument.
Well, Rami, you know, it's interesting to me that I know you like to accuse me of being milquetoast or whatever, but what I do try to do is to somehow accommodate to the extent possible. I mean, I think there are some points of view that are just off of, totally off the charts, beyond the pale, however you want to describe it. But I try to accommodate many points of view here on the Dave Graham Show and allow and give people a voice and due consideration and all that sort of thing. Here's an email I just got from a guy named Jim Christensen. It says, Dave, you are off the rails on bloodlines, a throwaway line by Trump referring to Ford's long history of adapting to change in the manufacturing industry can't be confused as an endorsement of anti-Semitism unless one is looking to be offended.
Well, that, so, if you take that one statement, and just that one statement, and you ignore everything else that Trump has said and done, it just ignore literally everything else. That one statement, okay, that guy might have a point. Might. I won't say he does have a point. I'd say you could sit there and probably have what you would call a cogent argument about it. On the other hand, if you look at Trump and you look at everything he said and everything he's done, and not just since 2016, but, you know, you go back in books that have been written about him and people, what people have talked about being around him. There's no question what there's fine people on both sides of an argument about Jews will not replace us means. There's no argument about what fine bloodlines for a well-known Nazi sympathizer means. Trump's initial support came just about 100% from the white wing, W-H-I-T-E, the white wing of the Republican Party. That's where his support all started from. You cannot...
Rama, let me... Here's the Washington Post. Here's the Washington Post from May 8th. They actually did a fact check on this very... On the Charlottesville events. And after his initial comments, Trump did some... attempted walkbacks here. I'll just read you one and see if it helps at all, okay? You tell me. Quote, you had some very bad people in that group, but you also had people that were very fine people on both sides. You had people in that group. There were people in that rally, and I looked the night before. If you look, there were people protesting very quietly the taking down of the statue of Robert E. Lee. I'm sure in that group there were some bad ones. The following day, it looked like they had some rough, bad people, neo-Nazis, white nationalists, whatever you want to call them. But you had a lot of people in that group that were there to innocently protest and were legally and very legally protest.
So, the innocent protesters there, that group marching up the street with their tiki torch parade, chanting Jews will not. Listen, if he doesn't come out and say These are the people. Trump has no problem coming out and saying nasty things about people who disagree with him politically, people that want to hold him accountable to the public for how he acts in our presidency. He has no trouble attacking people left and right. And he calls people the most vile names over Twitter. But, you know, Jews.
This is why.
Did not get a single, not one, zero, absolutely no negative response from him. None. He did not attack.
Well, Rama, I got to stop you and just tell, because I actually have a couple other callers coming in, so I want to get to this point pretty quickly, which is that I actually think that he, President Trump, if he were smart, he would make a some kind of
milquetoast.
Yeah, if he were smart, make some kind of speech, set of remarks or whatever, where he does renounce Nazism and talk about the horrors of the Holocaust and the whole thing, because you know, this has been a recurring issue here, where he's been accused of supposedly, you know, some kind of sympathies here that I can't imagine any U.S. politician wants to be accused of. So that would be a smart move on his part. I do have to move along to a couple of other callers here, though. Let's go to Dave in Plainfield. Thanks, Rama. Dave, are you there?
Good morning.
Good morning.
You know, I wish some of your callers were a little more educated. For instance, the Iranian problem. Carter's the one that started our problem with that. They ought to do a little history thing. And the other thing is, when they talk about Henry Ford, Charles Lindbergh, and the president of GMC were all friendly with Hitler because they thought he was on the right road. So, you know, tell them to do a little bit of investigating before they start mouthing off. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call, Dave. Let's go to Rich from Starksboro.
Good morning, Dave.
Hi, Rich.
I'm glad you brought Rama back into the fold here and didn't kick him out for good. I have to tell you, I agree with Rama's concept. But one of the things I want to point out from the get-go is I think your conversation with Rama got to where anti-Semitism and Nazism were synonymous terms, and they're absolutely not. And to me, I don't know, I'm not an expert, but I know those two words are just not the same thing. One of the things that Hitler did was able to brainwash his subjects. He had this Heil Hitler thing, and that, you know, that has nothing to do with anti-Semitism or any ethnic thing. And I think Trump has that. I guarantee you 100%, there's over a million people in this country who believe that Trump has never lied in his life. And so we got
a problem. I suspect you're right about that. I do think on the history, though, that if I'm actually in the middle of right now reading The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. It's quite a thick book, but I'm hoping I'll make it all the way through it. And this anti-Semitism and Nazism basically really were like two crossed fingers. I mean, they, you know, I don't want to say they're
more to Nazism than. And you have to run a government with Nazism. There's more to it than just anti-Semitism.
Yes, you're right. But anti-Semitism, a huge feature of Nazism. And I mean, you know, when you talk about the symbology, like swastikas and so on, there have been quite a few folks with swastikas, or at least some folks with swastikas, at these recent rallies demanding that various states be reopened. You know, the near attack on the Michigan Capitol, Lansing, a couple of weeks ago, featured people with signs and flags, et cetera, including swastikas. And
but it's also more than anti-Semitism. The gypsies, he killed gypsies.
Yeah, no, I understand that. But so the but really, I mean, if you look at it. Essentially, you know, Nazism had this whole fascination with blood, with genetic with the bloodline, good quote unquote good bloodlines. I mean, that's something that the Nazis really talked about a lot. And so for President Trump to come out and talk about this guy who was apparently sympathetic enough toward the Nazis to accept a medal from them in 1938, to talk about him having good bloodlines, I just think demonstrates either a really tin ear, you know, somebody who is going to step in it. And you know, if you add this to the Charlottesville remarks, and you add this to the fact that instead of lamenting the Nazi invasion of Poland, President Trump last September congratulated Poland on the 80th anniversary of the Nazi invasion. Congratulations, you've been invaded by Hitler's forces. What? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Right.
And if you add the fact that Trump lately has been praising these protesters who are showing up at state capitals, you know, over the shutdowns, and you know, some of these protesters are carrying swastikas, and so I think he really needs to say, I am not endorsing, do not support, do not condone, you know, I do have no tolerance for people carrying swastikas. It's a symbol of a horrible regime, the worst ever, basically. And
that thing with these one, the protest and the coronavirus, anything he does is kind of crazy. Like, it's kind of how you win your subjects over, you know, and get them to Heil Hitler, you know.
Yeah, well,
call that thing.
Yeah. Rich, anyway, I got to move along, but I appreciate the call.
Your time, it kind of piqued my interest anyway. Thank you very much.
Alrighty, take care. Let's go to George in Berlin. Good morning, George.
Hey, Dave. Good morning. It seems like every day I turn the DEV on, it's just one more bash fest on Trump. You know, you're cherry picking stuff here and there. You got Rama to you know, throw in his comments and support it. I think you lose a lot of listeners. I don't tune in nearly as much. I just get sick of hearing it. And Trump has done a lot of good things. I think a lot of Israelis love Trump. I'm happy to see what he's been doing for the Israelis. You know, I think nobody's been through what we've been through right now, you know, and Monday morning quarterbacking is always going to be correct. But you got to give the guy a break. You know, what comes out of his mouth is probably what just runs through his brain. Whereas a lot of presidents like Obama, every single word that came out of his mouth was metered and measured as to its political value. And I would just as soon have somebody who just lets it rip than, you know, to figure out some guy who's measuring every word that comes out of his mouth.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call, George. I do try to allow both sides. Your call is welcome on the air here. I will say, that even earlier on in my own discussion of this event, I wanted to say there is a plausible, innocent interpretation, which is just the poor choice of words by the president. You know, when you talk about bloodlines, you talk about bloodlines. You know, as I mentioned, Henry Ford is actually not German by ancestry. So, but you know, the Nazis had this. Real interest in bloodlines, and so again, very, very poor choice of words. I don't make this stuff up. I mean, you know, the thing, you accuse me of bashing the president every day, but I just come on and offer some commentary occasionally about something the president has just said that's in the news. And so I do think that it's fair. It's and again, I welcome calls like yours to, I gather you're a supporter of President Trump, and that's entirely up to you. So let's one last call here. I think another supporter of President Trump, Jeff from West Braintree. Good morning, Jeff.
Hey, good morning. Excuse my voice. But anyway, you know, I've never seen anything like it. The news media, the fake news media, and you're part of it, have pushed this narrative against Donald Trump that he's just terrible, no good. You were wrong about Russia. you've been wrong about impeachment. And where, by the way, where were you guys when this coronavirus thing broke out and Trump put the travel ban on China? You know where you guys were? You were trying to impeach Trump, wasting money between the impeachment and the Russia hoax. I think it's $50 million you spent on that. Wouldn't that money be nice right now in the people's pockets, especially some of us in here in Vermont that can't work? And I would suggest, but I'm no doctor, but you got a real bad case of Trump derangement syndrome. You might want to get it looked at. Anyway.
Okay, thanks, Jeff, for the call. Yep. Speaking of Trump derangement syndrome, I know that that's a favorite phrase of Trump supporters. I frankly think, I don't know if it's real derangement or something else that causes someone to go to the Ford Motor Company plant in Michigan and praise the anti-Semitic founder of the Ford Motor Company as having good bloodlines. I don't know. I mean, who's got the derangement syndrome? You know, somebody who says that there were very fine people on both sides in Charlottesville when pretty much all of the marchers there who showed up to protest the removal of the Robert E. Lee statue were members of neo-Nazi and white supremacist groups. I don't claim to be a psychiatrist or psychologist or any expert on what officially accounts as derangement, but I really do think I'd love to see some genuine, unimpeachable, shall we say, there's a choice of words, sanity from the president to come out and say, by the way, for anybody who doesn't understand, I am staunchly opposed to anything anywhere near resembling Nazism. All right, we're going to take a brief break for some bottom of the hour news here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. When we return, we're going to be talking with Meg Hansen, a Republican candidate for lieutenant governor. Back shortly, folks.
A message from the Warren Store. Life bounces us around to places we never would have imagined. The best we can hope for is that we approach it with grace, strength, purpose, and humor. Experiences like these will be remembered all our lives. How we responded and changed with challenge, countless stories of kindness, innovation, bravery, and good humor have captured our imagination and raised our spirits. The human spirit is far more powerful than what we're dealing with now. We will get through this together.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
Yeah, we're back, and wanted to start out this half hour with a little bit of a traffic advisory. It turns out that Route 15 through Lamoille County up by the Lamoille Valley Union High School is very heavy traffic this morning. There's a food distribution center popped up there. The Vermont National Guard and Vermont Food Bank have been joining to distribute food to folks who need it, and it's drawing a lot of traffic. So if you are not going there to get food and you don't have to be traveling through that area, best to avoid Route 15 near the Lamoille Valley Union High School this morning. So just a word to the wise and folks who might want to save some time on their travels today. So anyway, I want to bring in my next guest. Meg Hansen is a Republican candidate for lieutenant governor here in Vermont. We're having a little communication issue with Ms. Hansen. We're hoping to get her back on the line in just a moment. But we are trying to organize here on the Dave Graham Show from time to time a sort of series of Meet the Candidates shows here, where we just bring in candidates for either of Vermont's top two state offices, the governor and lieutenant governor, and ask them why they're running and what they hope to accomplish in the job if they get it, and et cetera, et cetera. And so this is I think we started. We've had a couple of these now, but Meg Hansen is back on the line now with us. And Meg Hansen, I really appreciate you joining me this morning.
Well, thank you for having me on your show, Dave.
Glad to do it. So tell us a little bit about yourself, your professional background, and your first off, I will dare to ask you how old you are and have you run for office before and this kind of stuff.
Right. Okay. So I'm happy to share my story with your listeners. I was born in India, left when I was 7 months old. I'm a naturalized United States citizen who has an Indian heritage, of which I'm very proud. I moved to the Upper Valley region in southern Vermont 10 years ago to attend Dartmouth College. I have a medical degree, though I don't practice medicine. My professional engagement and experience has been in the field of healthcare policy, journalism, and politics. I own my own small communications firm through which I've been active in my community for several years, whether it's writing a weekly newspaper for the Rutland Herald and Times Argus, or creating and hosting a local TV show that discusses how Vermont's policies, various policies, affect the lives of Vermonters. And no, I've not run for office, but I think that question, that's asked of individuals, my understanding is that the basis of that is, have you put in the time? You know, have you put in the time in terms of engagement with politics and serving your community? And I believe I have, in terms of my own strengths, my own experience, and things that I feel that I could do that best serves my fellow Vermonters. And so, as I said, you know, with my own communications firm, and also, of course, my healthcare experience, I believe that I have the competence, the knowledge of Vermont's various issues and solutions that we don't hear in our public sphere. And, I mean, the main reason why I'm running for this statewide office is because I'm in my mid-30s, as is my husband, and Vermont is not a place where we can afford to buy a house. We can't afford to raise children here, something that I really want to do. We can't afford to create wealth and prosperity for ourselves and hope to retire here. And this story is what we hear when we hear the word demographic crisis and why young Vermonters are leaving. This is the story for middle-class families, working-class families, and also our seniors who are not able to retire here comfortably in a safe way. So it's about putting forward a vision of prosperity. And by that, I don't just mean financial abundance. I mean emotional, mental, physical prosperity and the freedoms that we need to be empowered with in order to create prosperity and to create the lives that we want for ourselves and our families. And that is the main message of this campaign and why I'm running for this office.
Let's talk a little bit about policy at a general level, and then maybe we'll get into a couple of specifics a little bit later. But I wanted to ask you, are there any particular things that state government is doing right now that it should stop doing, and or are there things that state government is not doing right now that it should start doing?
So if I want to just talk very broadly, the first aspect would be economic freedom, something that most Vermonters don't have. So deregulation would be a really great way. Now, PC, people confuse deregulation with a free-for-all, you know, do whatever you want. I don't need any safeties or precautions. No, I don't mean that. There are many aspects when it comes to land use regulations. Act 250 gets the most attention, but there are many, many regulations that get triggered when businesses want to expand grow or diversify. There are many restrictions that shackle business owners when it comes to the high tax burden. That's another aspect. So if you want to look at the economy, shackling it with various punishing taxes and regulations is one thing that the government is doing that is bad. Another aspect is in healthcare. We have monopolies, whether it's the UVM network, whether it's Blue Cross Blue Shield of Vermont. There are very many powerful monopolies that have made healthcare access just worsened it, has worsened overall health outcomes. One of them is something called the all-payer model, which unfortunately not a lot of Vermonters know about because we don't hear much about it. It's run by a company called OneCare Vermont. This is something I've been investigating for over 2 years now. That's another aspect that's really reduced access, reduced overall health quality, eats up a lot of monies that we actually need in our pockets, especially right now. So that's another aspect. And then, of course, in education, when you look at the fact that this year we spend the highest, about $20,000 per student, and national average is $12,000, and yet the student outcomes are either average or below average. So
okay, let me stop you there before I lose track of this list. Let's go back to tax policy for a moment and ask you. You talked about the current tax structure being bad. What specific taxes would you eliminate or reduce?
I don't think that's the right way to frame the question. I think that what you need to understand is that New Hampshire is our twin state, and we're always competing with New Hampshire and then the other New England states. But New Hampshire doesn't have an income tax. That's a huge aspect. Now, as I said, I moved to the upper Connecticut River Valley region in southern Vermont, and that area has some towns that are New Hampshire, some towns that are Vermont. The number of Vermonters that go to New Hampshire to purchase groceries and to buy gas, I mean, we're losing so many millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in revenues, which is something that, you know, that's a problem right now when we have, you know, COVID-19, the fact that we have, what, $400 million budget for a shortfall. So we're always competing with that. Now, it's not about, oh, what should I eliminate? What should I not? That's actually a really good, it's a good insight, I think, into why I'm running. It's not about one little tweak here or one little tweak there. It's about a fundamental shift in the way that we deal with governance and the fundamental shift in the way that we want Vermont to run. So here's a really great way of enacting tax reform, which Colorado has done, and that's, of course, a blue state. And that is, I won't get into the weeds of it, but see, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. I'll just sort of briefly say it's about, you know, you can have revenue triggers and then tax reform. So basically you create a model, it already exists, when you say, okay, when the revenue goes up a certain amount, then we cut the tax rates by a little. And so that way we're not saying, oh, let's just cancel all the taxes, as you said, let's get rid of the sales tax, let's get rid of the income tax, and then we don't have the revenues for it. They're very smart, judicious, careful ways of reducing the punishing tax burden on Vermonters without then also, you know, looking at $1 billion in a budget deficit. There are smart ways of doing it. Other states have done it. Other blue states have done it. And I would recommend that Vermont do that too.
I guess I'm sort of trying to translate all of this into the pocketbooks of our listeners, and some of whom reside in the Connecticut River Valley and may travel over to New Hampshire because gasoline is cheaper over there. Of course, they got to burn some gas in order to cross the river, but that's another little aspect of it. But I'm wondering, you know, Vermont's fuel taxes right now are at the level they're at. Do they need to be reduced so as to eliminate the incentive that people in that area have to go across the river?
Let's just wave a magic wand and say Vermont didn't have a sales tax. Vermont didn't have an income tax. Vermont had a different tax structure. What do you think would happen? Do you think we would attract young people to Vermont? Do you think we would attract middle-class families and working-class families? Or would we continue to see the hollowing out of the middle class and the demographic crisis and the exodus? I mean, look, you and I or anybody can sit and argue about one little tax here or one little tax there. But we need to step back and look at the big picture and understand that the way things are going right now, it's not sustainable. Now, people in the media and people who are employed by the state government are fine. They're comfortable because, you know, you can work from home or you have a steady paycheck. But for the rest of Vermonters, right now we have 1 in 4 who are unemployed, and that might look like 1 in 3 by the end of the summer if the lockdown continues. So people are hurting. A lot of people are hurting. And now it's digital, of course, but when I campaign over the last few months, the number one thing I hear over and over again from Newberry to Burlington and Newport to Putney is that people are putting their houses up for sale and they're waiting to leave. And they want to go either to Tennessee, North Carolina, South Dakota, Florida, because they just can't afford to live here. And we know the fact already that this is happening for young people. So as you see with other lieutenant governor candidates, that, and this is something that I would encourage you and your listeners to think about, is that many people will identify correctly the problem, like what is the problem. But if you push further, will they identify the why? Because when you say, when you look to see why is this happening, why do we have a demographic crisis, why are middle-class families leaving, those answers, those real answers, are difficult because they go against the policy agenda that's been reigning in Montpelier for at least the last decade.
One of the techniques that the Democrats have been promoting in the legislature is to make Vermont more family-friendly, paid family leave, boosting the minimum wage to, say, $15 an hour, those kinds of ideas. What do you think of that sort of menu of approaches?
That's a great question, Dave. Here's my view of it. Outside of our personal relationships, outside of our family, work is a place where human beings in general find meaning, find purpose, and find value. They find community. So restoring the value and importance of work, I think, is the number one thing that we need to strengthen the social fabric of our communities and to also solve a lot of problems that we have. Now, this is different from handing out money. You know, that's the big difference when you look at an agenda and a fundamental shift. It's not just about giving a little more money. It's about giving people opportunities to have access to different kinds of productive labor, you know, and to say, you know, here's an opportunity for you to go way beyond the minimum wage. You can actually own your own business. You know, it's going outside these. I understand what, you know, the philanthropy aspect of wanting to give people more money and the caring, and that's there. But I still think it's very myopic, and I don't think that's very empowering. I think allowing people to be their own bosses, to, you know, make six-figure salaries and have their own plumbing business, I think that's far more empowering and far more productive for our society as a whole. So I would say rather expanding access to different forms of labor, and this is sort of where we can talk about what's happening with, you know, the Northern Vermont Universities and the Vermont Technical Center. Basically, trades, apprenticeships, expanding the definition of what it means to have a post-secondary education. You know, a four-year liberal arts degree at Dartmouth College may work for some people, but not for everybody. When we look at the statistics, most Americans don't go to college, and if they go to college, they drop out. So, you know, having different forms of labor and work and restoring the value of that, that's where I would go in terms of what policies can we do to promote that.
We have a couple of phone calls coming in from listeners. Let's go to Rick in Manchester. Good morning, Rick.
I don't know why me and my partner are hearing Meg for the first time on your program. We follow her in the media and love her fresh ideas for Vermont. We fully support her. I want to ask about dairy farm support. It could be the engine of our economy. Vermont is enjoying a brain drain from the other states, and hopefully people will come to Vermont as they come here from other countries. My wife always says, Meg, it's America's new sweetheart. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call, Rick. Meg, you got a fan down there in Manchester. That's a pretty pretty nice endorsement right there. I wonder your thoughts on the coronavirus sort of bump or whatever. Is Vermont going to attract people coming in based in part on its relatively excellent performance in fending off this threat of the coronavirus? And are we going to suddenly find ourselves a very attractive place to many people?
You know, that's hard to say because from my understanding that is that the governor has asked tourists who are coming in during the summer months to quarantine. And I don't know if that's going to be an attractive thing for people. in the short term. And, you know, I think that, you know, looking at this in a way that, okay, will coronavirus attract people? That's, I don't know. That's a very strange, I've never thought of that as a reason. I think that people would move here if they have economic opportunities, if there's a way to, you know, have an upwardly mobile career, not just a job. And, you know, if you can actually think, okay, I can raise my family here, I can actually buy a house. And I think that's really what would attract people to come here, you know.
One of the things that puts a pinch, I would think, I mean, you're a couple in your, you and your husband are a couple in your mid-30s. You said you haven't been able to buy a home and and you are, you'd like to have children, but haven't been able to, you know, haven't been able to afford that yet either. And I think that's a really sad tale, frankly. And I think it's being told by quite a number of people in, is particularly in your age bracket. So let's take a couple of these things apart. One is home ownership. Does the inability to buy a house have anything to do with the average housing price in Vermont? And if that's the case, what would you do about it?
Yeah, so the average salary, annual salary in Vermont is $46,000 here in southern Vermont. In my neck of the woods, it's $40,000. And a house, you know, a single-family house where you can have room for at least two kids is not, you won't get anything under $200,000. So,
right.
Yeah, absolutely. It has to do with that. So this is twofold. One is the fact that our economy is so weak, so structurally weak, when we have the government as the largest employer. You know, there's a problem right there. And because, I mean, if you really want growth in a robust economy, it's important for it to be diversified. It's important for it to be deregulated so that it attracts businesses, or even Vermont businesses that are here don't go out of business. So that's one aspect of it. And the second one is the land use regulations, as I talked about. Act 250 is just a, I just say that because people understand what I mean when I say Act 250. All those aspects add to the price of a house, of buying a property and then actually building a house. Everything adds to that. So it's sort of intertwined in terms of, I don't think you can just change one thing and say, okay, well, then it's done. It has to be a multi-pronged approach where you're looking at basically opening up the economy and allowing for wealth creation. And I think that would, and that by that it means, you know, less taxes, tax reform, deregulation, and having a pro-business mentality, you know, a pro-economic growth and pro-development mentality. So, for example, in Tennessee, they want people to come. You know, they want families to come. They say, come here and build a house. And they're putting in policies that attract people to come there. Same in North Carolina. We don't have that here.
In terms of the ability to afford kids, one of the big issues is, of course, child care. Just a minute to go, but can you tell us quickly if you have any thoughts on that front?
Yes, I think so. I think that, so right now the reason why we have childcare is because we need two people, you know, we need two incomes to be able to afford to have children. There are many men and women who would like to stay at home and look after their own kids. You know, that's the whole point of having a kid, not have it and then give it off to someone else to look after them. A lot of people, I would like to raise my own kids. You know, a lot of people would like to do that. So having more money in the pocket, which this is, again, the whole point about upwardly mobile careers and wealth creation, that would enable us to do that. As opposed to
all right, Meg Hansen, I got to go, but I really appreciate you taking the time with me this morning. Nice chatting with you, and let's do it again soon.
All right, thank you.
Sure, yep. Heading into a top of the hour break for some CBS News. We'll be back very shortly, folks.
A message from the Warren Store. Life bounces us around to places we never would have imagined. The best we can hope for is that we approach it with grace, strength, purpose, and humor. Experiences like these will be remembered all our lives. How we responded and changed with challenge, countless stories of kindness, innovation, bravery, and good humor have captured our imagination and raised our spirits. The human spirit is far more powerful than what we're dealing with now. We will get through this together.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
We're back. Thanks for staying with us into our second hour here on this Friday morning, May the 22nd. And I think we're going to be talking shortly with Bob Ney, one of our favorite national correspondents. I think he's the one who's been with us the longest here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. And he's a regular on Fridays these days. And we're really, really glad to have him join us. And while we wait Bob's arrival, just wanted to mention a couple of other news items of interest, and especially in the on the COVID 19 front. Washington Post is reporting that, contrary to earlier discussions about the coronavirus, the headline here is "Contaminated Surfaces Aren't a Big Risk," and so there was a significant discussion about needing to wipe down all surfaces and so on back earlier in the pandemic. And these days, folks, I think, are starting to realize this. The public health people are saying the easiest way to transmit coronavirus, it spreads primarily from person to person and not easily from a contaminated surface. That's the takeaway from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which this month updated its How COVID-19 Spreads website. And so something to take as a little bit of advice there for you. Meanwhile, there's quite a bit of opening going on around the state, really, in Vermont. Just opening Vermont's restaurants for at least some service, and we have other activities starting to gain a little traction here. And this is going on nationwide as well. Some of the states, though, that have been most aggressive about a reopening are in the South, and the South is now the focus of a lot of discussion that folks are seeing a resurgence of the coronavirus. There's actually, in some places, what's being described as a second wave, and so this is, I'm sure, a real concern to people. I don't know whether that means there are going to be any sort of reinstituted or reconstituted shutdowns, but we have to try to think about how to manage the loosening of the spigot, as the governor talks about, Governor Phil Scott, and we, while at the same time maintaining some kind of a tight rein on the incidence of coronavirus out there. This is going to be a tricky process. And boy, I read an article on Axios the other day talking about this and what going out to dinner might be like in restaurants. And it just struck me that there are going to be some awkward times. For instance, one thing they recommended was that you order everything from the appetizer to the dessert the first time the server comes by, so that you can minimize contacts between the server and the customer. That'll be new. And so most of the time, you know, part of a server's job is to keep an eye on your customers, and are they done with their appetizers? Are they ready for the main course? Are they done with their main course? Are they ready to be asked, would you like to look at the dessert menu, and et cetera? That's all apparently going to change at least in some restaurants. So, but when we get Bob Ney on, which I hope we will very shortly, he's going to be talking about, he sends up a coronavirus dashboard where he just takes some statistics, I think from WHO or the Johns Hopkins University, which has been keeping very close tabs on what's going on internationally and in the U.S. with coronavirus. Total confirmed cases as of 5 a.m. Eastern time today around the world, coronavirus 5,118,416. Total deaths, 333,000. Total recoveries, 1,960,000. Total in the U.S., total confirmed cases as of 5 a.m. Eastern Time, 1.578 million. Total deaths, 94,729. Total recoveries, 298,418. Total tested, 13 million. 056206. And in the federal governing aspect of this thing, Mitch McConnell, the Senate majority leader, is telling the President Donald Trump the next coronavirus bill must be under $1 trillion. And Trump says, we are not closing our country for a second wave. So there's the initial reaction from President Trump about a possible second wave. So let's see, on public health, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the infectious disease chief, is talking about this vaccine developed by a company called Moderna. And Fauci says he's, quote, cautiously optimistic. The CDC is conflating diagnostic and antibody tests. That's an interesting story and may have some application here in Vermont. We're going to try to delve into that a little bit next week on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. And let's see here, hydroxychloroquine. This is a drug, of course, President Trump has not only touted as a possible preventative or cure for coronavirus, but earlier this week, the president said he's taking hydroxychloroquine. Now there's new reporting out indicating from the Washington Post, for instance, that the hydroxychloroquine actually can increase the likelihood of death in coronavirus patients. And so there's real concern, I think, about the idea of taking this hydroxychloroquine. Another interesting aspect here is, of course, some people are long-term users of hydroxychloroquine for treatment of particularly rheumatological disorders, rheumatoid arthritis and other illnesses like that. And it's a pretty powerful drug, I'm told, that is much needed by certain classes of patients who have those kinds of disorders. And there's some concern that there could be shortages of hydroxychloroquine, which would perhaps deny the availability of this this drug to the people who have been, you know, on it for a while under close supervision of a doctor, and are worried about losing that access. So something to consider, I guess. You know, a lot of things that people try have side effects. I mean, that's a famous thing in medicine. A lot of health policies and other policies actually have side effects that and the famous unintended consequence and so on. Here's an interesting upside story for the coronavirus crisis. And we are seeing from The Guardian newspaper based in Britain. They have a U.S. edition. They say that wildlife is thriving in closed U.S. National Park. Deer, bobcats, and black bears are gathering around parts of Yosemite National Park, typically teeming with visitors. The bear population has quadrupled. And wow, that's pretty amazing. Earlier this month, for the first time in recent memory, pronghorn antelope ventured into the sun-scorched lowlands of Death Valley National Park, undeterred by temperatures that climbed over 110 Fahrenheit. The animals were observed by park staff browsing on a hillside not far from the Furnace Creek Visitor Center. And here's Katie Schmidt, spokesperson for the National Parks Conservation Association. She says, this is something that we haven't seen in our lifetimes. We've known they're in some of the higher elevation across the Death Valley, but as far as we're aware, they've never been documented this low in the park near park headquarters. And so that's an interesting, you could say, upside to the shutdown is that as people go away, wildlife reappear. And so if you like wildlife better than you like people, maybe that's a win for you. I don't know. But, well, it sounds like, we may, have to miss Bob Ney today because, he apparently is not getting on the phone with us as he normally does on Friday mornings, but that's okay. We make do with what we have. And speaking of which, I want to get into our conversation this morning with our corrections commissioner, James Baker, and the facilities chief with the corrections department, Al Cormier. The corrections department has been in the news quite a bit lately as it has worked to try to respond to the COVID-19 crisis, which obviously takes on a lot of special considerations when you're dealing with an incarcerated population, as these two gentlemen are. I've often referred to the corrections commissioner's job as the toughest job in state government. Jim Baker has previously held other jobs that might be tough at times, including director of the state police here in Vermont. And Commissioner Baker, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Dave, thanks for having us.
And Al Cormier, you are the facilities chief of the Vermont Corrections Department. You're kind of the frontline guy on this, I guess, on a daily basis. And I saw you quoted in a VT Digger article the other day saying fresh adjustments pretty much every day. And I'm sure that's keeping you busy, but I appreciate your time this morning. Thank you very much for joining me.
Yes, absolutely. Happy to be here. Thank you.
And Commissioner Baker, let me start with you and ask you overall, do you feel like you have got this thing pretty much under control, and I don't know whether beaten is the right word or licked or whatever, but how are we doing in the corrections department relating to COVID-19?
Well, I don't want to go as far as to say we have it beat or licked or whatever that word may be, or even under control, because I think part of the challenge with this virus has been the unknown nature of the virus. And as every day goes on, everyone that's working on this, no matter where you are, is learning more about the virus. And what I would say is that I feel very comfortable where we are as a department, especially when you look around the country with other state correctional facilities and systems. I'm pretty proud of the work the staff has done, and I feel very comfortable where we are in this process. But there is no time to let up. We need to stay focused.
Let me ask you about some of those metrics, because I have heard from, and I know some remarks recently from Mike Smith, your boss, who is the agency secretary of the Agency of Human Services in Vermont. That includes the Corrections Department, and so I guess you report to him. But he was saying that our Corrections Department is performing better by some metrics or several metrics on handling the coronavirus issue. And what metrics do you use? What are some of them telling us?
Well, again, I'm less worried about where we compared to other folks. Our focus, and it has been and will be, that every person that's under the statute in my custody, the Commissioner of Corrections in our care, and our employees are safe. And we've been focused on that since mid-February. I think one of the reasons why we've been as successful as we have is that we got focused very early on this issue. What I will tell you is, when you ask me about what metrics we're using, I'm hoping next week, as soon as I have the level of confidence that I have and other folks around me have, we've been working with a group called Recidivist. It's a nonprofit group that's been doing some modeling for us. And as we put more information into the system, I become more confident about where we are. And that modeling shows that we're at the point where we're beyond the peak, we're flattening out, and that if these numbers hold up, I'll be very, very happy with the results as the next month goes on. But we're waiting just probably another week or so, and we're going to make that model public once we test Marble Valley facility on Tuesday of next week.
Let me also ask, maybe I'll put this question to Al Cormier, the facilities chief. Can you tell me, if you're an inmate in, say, St. Albans or Newport, any of the facilities really, but how has this affected your daily life in your time in the facility since February? In other words, are there any restrictions on daily activities? Are there things that you used to be able to do you can't do anymore?
Yeah, it's been a huge impact on the inmate population. Initially in March, we canceled all in-person visiting, knowing that the biggest threat of the virus coming into our facilities is coming from the outside. We canceled the visiting. We canceled our volunteer services. You know, those are a lot of things that the inmate population depends on a regular basis to keep some sense of normalcy in their life. You know, our education programs, we canceled those. Our risk reduction programs, we canceled those. Again, all in an attempt to mitigate the exposure risks of that virus coming into our facilities. While it's not the best environment for that population, it is keeping them safe. And it's keeping the inmate population safe. It's keeping our staff safe. But it has drastically reduced what day-to-day life inside a correctional facility looks like. We've basically been on a modified lockdown for 2 months. To speak to the population, how serious they're taking this and how serious our staff have taken this, you know, we've had minimal, if any, issues in our population. Historically, if, you know, we've had an issue in our facility and we've had to go into a lockdown for more than 4 or 5 hours, you know, the inmate population gets antsy that they're not used to being locked in for that long of a period of time. And now we've been going on a modified lockdown for 2 months. So that speaks volumes to the patience of the inmate population. It speaks volumes to the professionalism of the staff and being able to keep, you know, the calm inside those facilities. We're utilizing video visitation. The inmates are issued tablets, so they have that access. They have messaging options on those tablets so they can keep in touch with their loved ones. We have started to ease up some of those restrictions, getting them outside on a regular basis, getting them into the day room on a regular basis, but it has significantly been restricted from what that population is used to.
Well, I mean, that strikes me as really a very difficult set of circumstances, and I'm wondering, these lockdowns are, I mean, this is still continuing right from the beginning of this pandemic, right?
Yes.
And the inmates, you say, have been demonstrating quite a bit of patience and et cetera. Fair to say they deserve to be commended at this point?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that for, you know, obviously, our, you know, we've reduced our population significantly in the last 2 months, 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
Those inmates are still locked in their cells. So yes, they deserve to be commended for the patience that they have shown and the restraint that they have shown and the understanding of the seriousness of this virus and what we're doing. And I think a lot of that goes back to the messaging from our staff, being able to inform them what's going on and keep them informed as to why things are happening. I mean, we still have mental health staff that are in our facilities, so they're able to meet with that population on a regular basis. So they're still getting those mental health services delivered to them. Medical services are still being delivered to them. You know, we're trying to have some sense of normalcy, but it's quite difficult, to say the least.
Are inmates wearing masks?
They are. Yeah, we've provided all of our staff and all of our inmate population with masks. Our facility in Newport, they started producing cloth masks when that became a recommendation from the governor, from the CDC, as far as the protection that those may provide. So we started with the cloth mask production, very simple design with bed sheets and rubber bands, and we've since moved on to manufacturing masks made out of a microfiber material. Based mm-hmm. on the research that we've been able to do, we've determined that those microfiber masks provide about a 70% to 75% barrier rate from transmission. So we've produced, I think it's upwards of 5,000 microfiber masks now out of our Newport facility that we've been able to deliver to staff and inmates alike. So all inmates are issued those microfiber masks now.
Are they required to wear them? Is it mandatory?
They are. If they're going to be out of their cell for, you know, for recreation or for any time into the day room or to go to a medical appointment or anything, they are required to wear those masks.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty standard for everybody these days when you're up and about and moving around outside of your normal living quarters or whatever, you are supposed to wear a mask. So, that's,
yes.
And But Commissioner Jim Baker, I'm wondering if you can reflect at all here on this, just the whole question of the rehabilitative aspects of a lot of the programs that were going on in the facilities before this crisis hit, programs which have had to be canceled, including visitation by family members and so on. I'm wondering, can you give me any indication of your sense that how that has affected the rehabilitation process in the facilities?
Well, look, one of the things I'll comment about, Dave, is that I came from the outside into corrections. I'm not a corrections person. I've been in the criminal justice system 45 years, but I've been on the front end loading the system, not on the back end, where the goal is to take good inmates into good citizens. It's been challenging. We had a shutdown programming for March and April, and we're just starting to breathe life back into that now by using electronics and trying to get that programming started up again. Programming is a big part of what corrections does. We use an integrated system, so it's as individual focus as possible. Focused on, we tend to focus on the person, not necessarily just the crime. We take everything into consideration, and it's going to be hard to say what that 2 months of non-programming has done, because it's too early to figure that out. But we have to get our programming back up and running. Some folks are being held because they haven't finished programming, and we need to get that done. But we had to make tough decisions like that early on in this process, based on what we were learning from the CDC and the health department about the spread. And again, going back to that model day, those kind of decisions got made for the greater good. And I think when we release the information from our modeling, it's going to indicate that we probably have one of the lowest spread rates in the country. And again, that was one of the many decisions that had to be made. And there's a consequence for it. We know that. So we're going to get that programming back up and running and focused as soon as we can.
All right. Well, Commissioner James Baker of the Vermont Department of Corrections and Al Cormier, the facilities chief, are my guests. We'll continue with this conversation after a bottom of the hour break for some CBS news and a couple of messages from sponsors. If listeners would like to call in, the numbers are 244-1777 or 1-877-291-8255. Back shortly, folks.
A message from the Warren Store. Life bounces us around to places we never would have imagined. The best we can hope for is that we approach it with grace, strength, purpose, and humor. Experiences like these will be remembered all our lives. How we responded and changed with challenge, countless stories of kindness, innovation, bravery, and good humor have captured our imagination and raised our spirits. The human spirit is far more powerful than what we're dealing with now. We will get through this together.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
Our guests are Commissioner James Baker of the Vermont Department of Corrections, and Al Cormier is the facilities chief with the Department of Corrections. They're both on the phone with me this morning, and as I mentioned before the break, listeners, you are welcome to call in if you have any questions or comments you would like these gentlemen leaders of the Corrections Department to hear. You are more than welcome to join the conversation. We're going to go to about 10 of 11 on this segment, and then I think we are going to bring in finally Bob Ney, who was supposed to join us for the first 10 minutes of the hour. It turns out he's going to be with us the last 10 minutes of the hour, but we're not letting Bob get away completely this morning. But I also wanted to mention, speaking of little programming notes and so on, just after the top of the hour when I quit for the day, we're going to have another WDEV live broadcast of Governor Phil Scott's regular news conferences. He has been doing these three times a week, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, at about 11 o'clock or a little thereafter every morning, and joined by other top state officials. I wouldn't be surprised at all. In fact, if you, Commissioner Baker, are you planning on being there this morning?
I am not.
Oh, okay. That's I know you attend some of those, but so the... The governor will be having this news conference with other top state officials this morning, and hearing from them once again live on WDEV. We're doing this as a public service for our listeners out there, and the governor's doing it, I think, also as a public service, just to try to keep Vermonters updated on what is going on with the state's response to the COVID-19 crisis. Commissioner Baker, I did want to ask you about a story that was in VT Digger earlier this week. It starts off like this. It says the State Department of Corrections is changing its mask coronavirus testing policy and will now test both staff and inmates at the state's prisons. The previous policy, as part of a mitigation strategy, was to only test staff in an initial phase. A single positive test among staff would trigger testing of any staff member not already tested, as well as all inmates at the site. Now inmates won't have to wait until a staff member tests positive to be included in testing at a facility. So tell us about that change, if such a thing actually, if that's, first off, I guess I'll ask, has the article got it right there?
Yeah, we made the decision to change what we were doing. There's a lot of factors that went into that. First of all, very early on, which is well reported, not only nationally but locally, we didn't have the capacity to test. And there were a lot of folks calling for complete testing of the facilities. But at the level of Secretary Smith and the governor's level, down to me as a commissioner, you know, the questions then become, where do you put the limited amount of testing that was out there at the time, the ability to collect and the ability to test? Because it's really two separate things. You know, you can't make decisions and split between nursing homes or facilities where developmentally challenged children are, or mental health, et cetera. And so we were limited. The original strategy was, and that's how we got to the Northwest facility in St. Albans. The original strategy was, if we had a positive test, then we would move to test our staff and the population. As the test became more available, and we started learning more about the testing process, and from the direction of the governor wanted to step up the amount of testing that was going on, not only in the correctional facilities, but throughout the state, and go on the hunt for the virus. And as part of that conversation, we made the decision that there was enough testing available. We had a better understanding of the testing. We had the scare of St. Albans, which, by the way, I'd like to mention, under the leadership of Al and the incident command staff, we were able to quickly isolate that virus when it hit Northwest. And part of that was our ability to test and our ability to understand contact tracing. The contact tracing played a big role in us being able to get folks cohorted away from each other based upon who we knew we had contact with. And so as that unfolded, we decided that we were going to change our policy as tests became more available. The capacity at the labs stepped up to the point where they could do more of the testing in the labs, and we thought it was a good strategy to move forward with, and that's what we did.
And this does sound like a really practical policy formulation process where this is really based on the sheer physical availability of testing kits. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, that was part of the day, right? I mean, the other piece of it is that if anybody in the beginning, as this all started unfolding at the end of February and the beginning of March, the knowledge about the virus is not what it is now. And, you know, even this morning I'm hearing news reports that what was thought to be the way the virus spread has now changed after more research by the CDC. There's times in a given day that we change policies twice in a day, simply because every single day we wake up and ask ourselves, what are we going to do today that was better than yesterday? And we're pushing ourselves based on the science. And the other point I'd like to make is that there's a lot of emotion, especially early on. People were very fearful of this and still are fearful, and emotions play into that. And we've tried very hard as a department not to let emotions get involved in our decision-making process, which we're basing upon science and research and good feedback from the experts that we're talking to on a regular basis.
The I've seen stories nationwide talking about corrections facilities in general. I mean, basic references here, they seem to be particularly vulnerable. Nursing homes, obviously, and meatpacking plants, which aren't really, we don't have any the huge meatpacking plants in Vermont that they do, say, out in the Midwest or whatever. But that is just really a function of kind of the close quarters of nursing home residents or inmates or meatpacking workers, right? I mean, isn't that
correct?
It's really proximity is a big part of the problem here, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I think that's part of the problem. And obviously, when you run a jail system, social distancing becomes challenging. But, you know, early on in this process, it's one of the many prongs of the strategy was to try to get our population down so we could spread out the distance. And the other part was the surge location that we opened up in St. Johnsbury. And as soon as we had the situation in Northwest, the plan was well established. And I'm telling you, the staff executed that plan flawlessly to move the positive inmate population over to St. Johnsbury to get them isolated. But I will also say, Dave, that one of the things that impressed me when I got here, you know, people have this vision of what a prison looks like, a jail, a prison. You know, I like to refer to them as facilities. And people have this idea of what a facility would look like, this dark, dirty place. And the Vermont Department of Corrections, long before I got here, has prided itself on keeping those facilities clean. And I'm not saying nursing homes aren't clean or meatpacking plants aren't clean, but we had a leg up on this because the cleanliness of the facilities were top shelf to begin with. And part of our strategy was to really step up the cleaning process 2 and 3 times a day. And I think it played a big part in containing the virus to this point. And we're not out of this yet. We got to stay focused. But I think that played a big part in it as well.
You've had a lot of a pretty steady spotlight put on the correction system. In particular by the ACLU of Vermont. Do you think they've been helpful, or have they been a little bit over the top at times? Or what's your general sense of their role in the conversation about the corrections system in recent months?
Well, look, my days when I worked in Washington, I worked very closely with the folks on the national level of ACLU. They have a view. We all have a view. I think at the end of the day, everybody wants the same thing. It would be ridiculous for anyone, and I'm not saying ACLU has said this, but it's ridiculous for anyone to think that the Commissioner of Corrections in Vermont is so careless that he doesn't care what happens to the population inside the jail or the staff that work in the jails. That would be ludicrous. And I think we've got the same goal in the end. I do think, and this again is not directed at the ACLU, but there has been a lot of talking points that come from the national level that are just not applicable to Vermont. I mean, there's a study out there that talks about predicting 100,000 deaths in jails, and it's based on 15 of the largest county jails in the country. And that is not a comparison to what the Vermont system is. You know, I'll take, for example, just because I'm familiar with it from my national work, you know, Cook County Jail is in the middle of the city of Chicago, in one of the areas where the high level of positives out in the community are high. And we know that in cases where it gets inside the facilities, it comes from the outside. And so the comparison is apples and oranges. And so what we've tried to do as a department is not react to emotional pleas and focus on data, on science, and make good decisions every day that's going to protect the inmate population, our staff, and the communities around us, who we owe to keep them safe as well as a result of our presence in their community.
The ACLU has also called for significant reductions in the numbers of inmates that are housed in Vermont's facilities. I mean, they were calling this for a while, and but they believe that the COVID-19 crisis really points up the need for that to be happening. What is your sense, Commissioner Baker, as to whether whether Vermont has done all it can do or whether there's more to do in terms of reducing inmate populations in the state?
Well, look, you know, we've reduced our population since March by 12%. That's not easy to do. A lot of the population, we don't even have control over. So pretrial detainment, we have absolutely no control over that. Folks that are sentenced to a certain sentence in jail, we have no control over that. And so we as an agency have worked pretty hard. And I think the numbers, I don't have the exact number here, Dave, but some data that I looked at that I had asked for, I believe we've reduced the population, although it's starting to fluctuate a little bit right now upward. And some of that is arrest and detainees that are coming in. I think the number that we had reduced at the peak of this about a week and a half ago was the population had been reduced by 305. And out of that 305, go ahead.
I was going to ask Al Cormier, the facilities chief, deep into the Digger story. I'm reading the I was reading earlier the I think they were saying the inmate population in St. Johnsbury, the folks have been moved there. There were some positives, meaning people with the coronavirus moved to St. Johnsbury. That caused a lot of consternation in the community. I remember hearing from a couple of legislators over that way who were expressing a significant upset about this. But it looks like it's been a fairly successful or very successful thing because the recent testing of inmates in St. Johnsbury shows that everybody's negative. Nobody still has the coronavirus. Is that right?
That is correct. It was, you know, we sent St. Johnsbury up as our medical surge site at the beginning of this. And, you know, we had had conversations with the town of St. Johnsbury town officials and that information was out there. It came quickly. You know, when we started getting those positive tests back from Northwest, we had to react immediately. And, you know, we've said we could have communicated much better, but in the long run, those, you know, we have opened up those lines of communication, both with the legislative body out of Caledonia County, the town manager in St. Johnsbury. And it was a success. You know, we've successfully housed upwards of 45 inmates in St. Johnsbury that were positive for the COVID-19 virus. The testing that was completed there last week, 103 staff, all negative. I mean, that's medical staff, that's correctional staff, administrative staff. There were 27 inmates that were tested that had remained housed in St. Johnsbury to assist with cleaning, laundry, kitchen workers. Those all came back negative. The system that Superintendent Nora Quinn put into place in St. Johnsbury with her staff, phenomenal. I mean, they set up different zones and cold zones and hot zones, and the lengths that they went to ensure that the donning and doffing of PPE was followed. And I mean, they did an amazing job there, and it was really a model that should be looked at from a national level for correctional facilities and how to contain a virus. It was just some amazing work.
Speaking of models, last question, Commissioner Jim Baker. What do you think is the most important thing you and the department have learned in the course of this pandemic?
I think what we've learned is how well we can operate under a high level of pressure, under a scrutiny of a whole host of outside stakeholders. And we've learned that we can break down what were traditional teams inside the organization, reform those teams into a very comprehensive, well-operating response to a situation that was unparalleled in the past. And so, quite frankly, I think as tough as this has been, the budget consequences that are going to come out of this are going to be very difficult. But I think the Vermont Department of Corrections is in a great position to take a serious look at itself and start redesigning the way it operates, because we will have to, because of some budget pressures that all state government is going to be under. And I think the lessons we learned inside this process are going to serve us well moving forward. as we take a look at what corrections looks like 5 years from now.
All right. Well, Commissioner Jim Baker and Facilities Chief Al Cormier, I want to thank the two of you very much for joining me this morning. Interesting conversation on important topics. That's what we try to do here, and I appreciate your participation very much. Thank you.
Dave, we appreciate the opportunity you gave us. Thank you.
And now, in these last few minutes of the program, we have Bob Ney joining us to provide some national perspective on the news. And good morning, Bob. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, good morning. Sorry I was late before. It got backed up out of control.
That's okay. So talk to me a little bit about what is happening out there on the national scene. We had quite a discussion earlier on the show here about these remarks the president made yesterday in Michigan about Henry Ford, the famous industrialist and famous anti-Semite, having good bloodlines. Did you catch that story at all?
Yeah, I saw something on that. I didn't dig into the whole thing, but I did see some controversial things. The most controversy was not wearing the mask, is what I had picked up, you know, that he didn't wear the mask.
Yeah, that is another another one. We've had a significant discussion about the other aspect of this thing earlier, so I won't delve back into it. Sure. With you So what are your other headlines out there this morning?
Well, actually, I did want to say something about Joe Biden because he doesn't necessarily get a lot of ink. Will change, by the way. That'll change. But Joe Biden is vetting definitely what they're calling an invasive vetting process for vice president, nominee. And that'll be interesting because I think that they're going to come at some point in time fairly quick to a decision, prior to the convention, because sometimes that's held till the very day of the convention. But I think they're going to do that. And also the fact that the polls are still out there. And I'm waiting for some more current ones from four different polling sources I look at. But Biden seems to have widened the gap. He's definitely beating the president when it comes to how President Trump handles the coronavirus, but the president's still on the economy, even after everything that's happened. People aren't relating that the president didn't handle coronavirus well enough, and then the economy, was hurt quicker. They're not relating that. They're still giving a plus to the president on the economy and a plus to Joe Biden on the coronavirus, and it makes Joe Biden ahead, overall. With the entire race right now.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, then the other story, the federal appeals court is asking the judge in the lower court case to say why he wants to do what he wants to do with Flynn, of sort of, outside parties interested in maybe doing something further with Flynn, although Justice Department dropped the issue.
So just to back up for a bit in the current status in the Flynn case, which is a pretty interesting matter. This is where the Justice Department came in and said, we want to drop charges against this guy who pleaded guilty. And then the judge they were putting this in front of said, wait a minute, I want to hear some counter arguments from another former judge, I guess. And also, I want to allow other outsiders to weigh in and say, is this a good idea or not? And then I gathered that ruling was subject of an appeal. They call it an interlocutory appeal, I guess, to the Federal Appeals Court, which is now done what? I'm not quite up to the latest, I guess.
You've got it all up to there. And the appeals court now, if you read the one headline, which is so a misgiving of a headline. The headline says that they're calling the judge sort of on the carpet. They're not. The appeals court is saying to the judge who made this decision to allow outside people to weigh in on Flynn and what the Justice Department did dropping his case, the appeals court simply says, because it's been appealed by Flynn's lawyer, simply says, basically, we want you to tell us what your rationale is for not going along with the government dropping the case. So this is no indicator that court necessarily is going to overrule that judge. I mean, they may, But the way the headlines were written, it looks like, you know, the judge is in trouble. Well, he's not. So the judge is going to have to do his explanation, the government argued.
Yeah. Twists and turns in this thing are, I mean, beginning with the initial twist of a you know, prosecution coming in to say, hey, we got this guy to plead guilty, but we didn't really mean it. Kind of that set the head spinning right off the bat. This latest is, I guess, another spin of the head or something. So we'll have to keep our eyes on this one. Bob, I think that should cover us about for today, because I'm coming up to the top of the hour here and I got to quit myself. Gotcha. So I really appreciate you joining me. Let's do this again.
Okay.
Next Friday.
Thank you.
Sounds good.
Thank you
so much. All right. This is the last minute of today's Dave Graham show here on WDEV FM and AM. The governor comes up next after the CBS News to hold his regular news conference. They go Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Of course, today being Friday, the governor and other top state officials talking about the response to the coronavirus crisis. So stay, don't touch that dial, as they say. Stay right here with WDEV for live coverage of that event. And meanwhile, I will wish you all an excellent weekend. Continued good health, lots of hand washing, and enjoy this beautiful weather. We'll talk to you all on Monday.